Hello and welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts. And this episode is going to be a little bit different than the format so far. The initial format was I created this podcast. My name is Daniel Rosehill. I created this podcast with the idea of it being an AI-generated podcast. I sent my prompts to an AI agent and had an AI text-to-speech tool synthesize. And basically, I created this podcast and website that's sharing the episodes as a tool for myself, essentially. Sometimes I create long prompts for AI tools and I want to listen to them at my convenience and often don't really get around to it. And to kind of prevent that from happening, whenever I had something really kind of, usually kind of very technical prompts, I just created a pipeline that my prompts get sent to an AI tool. It is instructed to act as a podcast host, generates a script, and then that gets synthesized and that becomes the podcast. So that's what this is. Anyone's invited to listen to, with the caveat that occasionally, like everything in the universe, might not be 100% accurate, but I do put quite a lot of effort into ensuring that the information is as accurate as at least I can assess it to be. And the V2 of the podcast, that is a slight twist, is I got the AI generated voices to a level where I enjoy listening to them, which is challenging because generally that requires, it's quite expensive to get good text to speech. And I stumbled upon a nice alternative to 11 Labs, which is great, probably the gold standard for human-like natural text. And the idea is not really to pass it off as a human, it's a very transparently AI generated initiative, but just that it's nice to listen to. The difference between a very robotic voice and a very pleasant voice, whether it's a voice clone or a totally synthetic voice, is night and day in my experience and makes a difference between me looking forward to listening to my podcast and me being, this is awful. This is like listening to one of those like intercom systems where the text is synthesized. So I got that right, and V2 is, I decided it would benefit from a little bit of humanity. So it's, my prompts are now being, I changed the pipeline that makes these episodes a bit so that my prompts are actually preserved. Then I turn over to the agents. It's the same pipeline as before, but my prompts are added to it. So it's really a co-hosting initiative. So for those who want to subscribe to that, you want to listen into the stuff that I send into prompts that I send to the great world of AI and listen back to the responses in the format of an engaging podcast that isn't Notebook LM, then subscribe, Spotify, and mywordprompts.com. Now, my initial plan for this episode was actually to do a standard episode. This is a prompt that I wanted to send, but I kind of jumped the gun a bit by already running these prompts, so it felt a bit pointless to do that. And I have really got a few more thoughts than I have questions. And I don't think there's really, I'm going to get much more information out of prompting this again. So the prompt was as follows. And I'll just recount this experience, how I made this discovery. And I have to say, I'm thinking of a friend of mine called Gabriel, who is a privacy skeptical man. I should probably refer to him by some kind of a code name. But that is his name. We won't share any other information about him. And Gabriel's a very nice guy, and he is more on the kind of privacy skeptical end of things, which I can definitely identify with, because throughout my journey with technology, that was me for a long time. And I've just kind of, at this point, I've just kind of resigned myself to some degree of intrusion of privacy is just a fact of life. But I get where he's coming from in general, and especially with AI, it definitely is a concern in terms of copyright violations and IP theft. That's been going on in a big way, and we're finally seeing some really meaningful, I think, developments against that in terms of models that are trained on totally consensual data. We're seeing a lot more strict controls around. We're seeing Cloudflare actually rolling out some brilliant functionality. I think as a marketer, at least initially, I kind of view it from the 180 degree perspective. I think there's actually a huge opportunity in going totally against this grain of putting up walls against AI crawlers and structuring your website to make it easy. But I see both sides of the picture. If you've got proprietary IP, for sure, put out all the blockers at the firewall level, but you can do both. I think that's probably the right approach for most people, will be to say, this is stuff is fine. This is not for scraping. And of course, like everything in the great world of SEO, LLMs.txt, robots.txt, you can write a robots.txt saying no one can visit the site or no one can index the site. And there's no great internet authority that will come and track down a bot being operated from China saying, hey, you didn't obey the robots.txt. So it's important to understand, I think, that for all these safeguards that exist in technology, that there's no guarantees about compliance necessarily. Anyway, so I was working on my podcast pipeline a few days ago because it's something I really want to get going. I look forward to when I create these episodes and go out on walks and listen to them. And I was using a great TTS engine called Chatterbox from Replicate. I don't know actually if Chatterbox, it's from Resemble AI, I think actually. It's deployed on Replicate, and it's a text-to-speech engine that is kind of, it's very, very good. It is open source, so you can run it locally if you have the sufficient hardware. You can actually run it even on your CPU, but it might be a bit laggy. And I was using my generative AI assistant of choice, which is Claude Code, to work on the pipeline a little bit, trying to just get it right and trying to automate the process, really. But that was what I was doing. So I was providing the Chatterbox spec to Claude, which is basically just saying this is how to use it, so that it was able to just finish off the script to make it work. And I was just glancing over it, looking at the docs. Okay, this is just seeing what the API is, the API routes, etc., routine stuff. And then I noticed just at the end, it says, everything you generate with Chatterbox is stamped with a digital watermark that will survive audio manipulation and compression. And that was the first time I heard of that technology. I'm pacing through my living room, so I don't have my screen up in front of me, but the name evades me. But it's a widespread industry technology. And that was interesting to me because Chatterbox, most TTSs, to diverge for a second and to mention Gabriel again, being a privacy sensitive guy, so I had this... this tool, Chatterbox, works by what's called zero-shot voice cloning, which is essentially for voice cloning, to clone somebody's voice, a voice. The kind of traditional way it's done or could be done is by the same model really as is used to train AI tools in general, which whether we're talking about LoRA for image generation, creating a deepfake of a graphic of a person, or even if we're talking about training a large language model to follow a specific style, it's large language models, the transformer architecture, it's fundamentally about prediction. So you're giving it lots of examples of the thing and saying you... So voice training is kind of a bit like that. There's different ways you structure the audio data set. There's different requirements for how much data. Generally, there's kind of a minimum that you need. And beyond that, samples of a good quality, and you'll be able to clone a voice. Now, it's kind of an imperfect technology. I've seen it used professionally. I've seen been involved actually in a couple of book publishing initiatives where the author actually very consensually worked with a voice cloner. And the results are kind of up and down, but zero shot is, and we're talking about voice cloning, we have to talk about deepfakes and malicious uses, black hat uses for this technology. That kind of effort to clone someone's voice non-consensually is very feasible if it's a famous person. You know, if you can go onto YouTube, if you wanted to clone Donald Trump's voice, you won't have any difficulty in creating a perfect voice clone. Why? Because you can go onto YouTube, you can find a few very good voice samples, high bitrate, low background noise, gather up enough training data, train a voice clone. So that's been a threat for a while now. Zero Shot kind of puts that on steroids. It says with 10 seconds of audio, we'll get a great voice clone. And to come back to Gabriel, so this is just an idea that I had. I get these shower ideas, as they're called. And it was this for a horror movie because I like horror as a genre, but I also like true stories. And besides, if you believe in ghosts, you've got some options there. If you don't, you've got a few kind of creepy serial killer shows. But this is a great movie plot. But it's based on real life. So the plot, I said, have a look at the script idea. No one got back to me, so probably they thought I was half crazy before, or half down the rabbit hole to insanity. That was a response that you've gone fully off the beaten track. But the idea was, if you have someone around for a dinner party, the plot was someone has friends around, they've got a hidden camera, they take 10 photos or 20 photos, and they deep fake their friend. The friend's like on the internet looking for something, and they say, hey, wait, how am I in an ad? And this was just based on the first time I tried to do a Laura of myself. I took 20 photos of myself during the first few days of my son's life. Well, there were many hours of just being awake and hanging around in hospital. He was asleep, so I was just there trying to keep awake myself. And I said, wait, can I create just a clone of myself? So I took 20 photographs in this room, this cafeteria that was empty, and fed it up to Leonardo, created a clone. And I was like, oh, but wait, if I could do that so easily, couldn't someone just take photos, use photos of their friends or their own photos from Facebook? And again, that was the premise of my horror movie idea, was that this, a couple had a couple over for dinner, and there was like a hidden camera or something like that, and they cloned them. Plausible. And the really scary thing, as much as that's plausible, it's also plausible that you could take 10 seconds of someone, again, recorded non-consensually, or simply just a recording from anyone whose voice is on the internet, right? I have a YouTube channel. I'm putting out a podcast. There you go. You've got more than enough audio data. Anyone can clone my voice from this. Now, you might say, wait, Daniel, why are you releasing a podcast? And the answer is, what's the alternative? If it's so easy to be cloned, and this is where I've come to disagree with Gabriel's privacy protecting ways, just in practice, is because I don't see any way that that's preventable. Either you never, if you leave the house, you're being photographed, surveilled by, municipal cameras. If you release 10 seconds of audio on any platform at any point of your life, your voice can be cloned. If you release more than 10 photos on any platform that can be traced back and they can find you, your face can be cloned, and they can make images, they can make videos. So if you think you're going to, I don't see any way to prevent it, basically. So my plot for the horror movie to finish off was that loop was just kind of dystopian reality, which is a genre I love. It kind of Matrix-like, in which everyone, it goes from this isolated incident, it snowballs to everyone deepfaking everyone, and no one knows anymore. There's robots, it becomes robotic, and no one knows who's real and who's a clone. Anyway, so that was the premise of that was the idea. So Chatterbox here, okay, they have this thing. So I see that every time you generate something with TTS, text-to-speech, it's being stamped. And that was an interesting thing to know. And I guess if we're talking about deepfaking, and this is a real challenge of what's in the public interest, I think privacy versus the greater good versus the what's intrusive. And my next question, I was asking Gemini, I was just looking at this technology when I saw it in Replicates, in Chatterbox's sort of the API documentation. So I looked it up and it seemed very widespread. That's interesting to know. So my next question, I asked Gemini or ChatGPT. Okay, everything that we do with TTS, with a mainstream big provider, is probably being invisibly stamped. What about images? If I go on to replicate and I'm paying to use Nano Banana, some services have AI transparency policies, which I agree with. If you generate something with AI, you have to be transparent, saying this was AI generated. And again, it gets a bit blurry when you talk about stuff like Nano Banana doing in painting, where truthfully, it's kind of, if you really start thinking about it, digital photo manipulation, Photoshop, I use GIMP on Linux, this predates AI. We've been manipulating digitally reality for a long, long time. It's not an AI thing. So on the one hand, I think there's room to say it's kind of a bit hypocritical to just kind of target stuff that just happens to be AI, because it's machine learning or transformer based, versus something that's just doesn't exhibit any fake intelligence, because AI is not real intelligence. But that is a policy. So the answer of Gemini was that yes, there is a technology called SynthID, and it is something that Google came out of Google DeepMind, which is Google's AI research division. And it's basically exactly what you think it is. What you think it is I've often wondered, could this be a thing? And it is a thing. The thing is that it's steganography. Steganography is a great example, I think, of reality being more interesting than fiction. There's something else I learned recently besides these interesting technologies, which was the printed dots. So this is, again, something I thought it's like, if you say it, you think it's a conspiracy theory that someone posted on Reddit and went viral at some point, and it's actually a real thing. It was prints, steganography, basically embedded dots printed on paper that identified very, very specifically the manufacturer and I think the person who printed it. Sorry that this particular edition of my podcast is done without show notes. But that is a real thing. Fascinating Wikipedia page for those who want to read about the invisible or hidden printer dots. There's non-digital precedent for steganography, which is just purely, literally the definition of hiding in plain sight. Encoded messages that, I think the classic example is the CIA recruiting through newspaper adverts, classified adverts, and there's a lot of documented instances of terrorists using methods like this via, I think, eBay listings, whose actual purpose was transmitting encoded messages, maybe with a cipher or something like that. So not only is it a real thing in the digital world, it's a real thing in the non-digital world. It doesn't need to be digital. Digital steganography is actually totally accessible. You can download a steganography tool to encode a message into a PNG, an image file, that's invisible to the naked eye. So much as the audio stamping is invisible, you can't hear that it's not at an audible frequency. Likewise, the data, and you might wonder, that whole concept is kind of weird. How can you have something in an image that you can't see? And if you really start to think through that, then you do really feel like you're in the Matrix. If you look at kind of the range of information that we as humans perceive being limited to literally our biological abilities, and there is frequencies we can't hear, and images, digital images, everything digital comes down to being ones and zeros, binary data, least minus quantum computing, which we'll leave for another episode, as if I understand much about quantum. But with an image file, you see, open an image on your computer, but you don't see everything in the file. You're not looking at ones and zeros. You're not seeing metadata, which is data about the data. And within that ones and zeros is hiding in plain sight a message. Now, my question for Gemini, which was where I was prepared to take a stand, or where I was prepared to formulate an opinion as to whether I support or disagree with this concept, was the following. If it's a encoded message saying that this was AI generated, I think I probably support it, to be honest. That means that, sure, you can disclose that it's AI generated, but if there's a black hat use case, someone is creating and trying to really pass off as real something, there's something hidden that most people are not going to be able, are not going to try to defeat. Now, that's the problem, cat and mouse. When the cat moves, the mouse moves too. So just as there's CAPTCHAs to try to defeat bots from scraping websites, and now there's anti-CAPTCHA technology. Sorry, there's CAPTCHAs and there's technologies to defeat CAPTCHAs. That's why CAPTCHAs are there. Well, sorry, not really. Scraping happened, then people put up CAPTCHAs to try to prevent bots from scraping. And then the people scraping said, wait, why don't we try to write a script to fill in the CAPTCHAs? So that's what's going on. It's a crazy game of cat and mouse. And so too for SynthID. I was reading an experiment in which someone achieved an 80% success rate in defeating it. In defeating the SynthID, removing it, obscuring it, obfuscating it from what it was watermarking. Now, what I think is really the question for privacy folk, the really interesting privacy question is, what does the invisible data say? Does it just say it was generated by AI, or could it be used to identify the user that generated the generation? And that's a very, very big difference from a privacy standpoint. At the first point, yeah, I support it. At the second one, that's very, very invasive. That is everything that you create on a platform being traced back to the individual user. And at the very least, I think it's just something that deserves transparency. People need to know about this, or should know about it, beyond it just being a very interesting thing. And there is an issue with the transparency, I think, being that this needs to be in plain language and TOS documentation. And it's fundamentally not very transparent, because when we talk about encryption, if you're going to have an encoded message, you could have an encoded message that if you're able to see it, you can read what it says, but that's not really how it works. It's an invisible code. It's not only invisible, it's a code that's invisible. So even if you were able to see it, it'd be like looking, if you try to open a document that's encrypted with PGP encryption on your computer, you'll just see random characters. It's not readable. So that's what you'd see if you could see the fingerprint that was being left. And how do you defeat that? How do you know what it says if you can't read it? And that's a problem. When we talk about encryption, someone encrypts something, they hold a key. And if you hold a key to encrypt, you can decrypt. If you don't hold a key, the only way to decrypt it is through brute force, and that's basically whoever has the bigger supercomputer. And that's where quantum is, maybe in the future, going to pose an issue to cryptography, because nation states that have those resources already, those capabilities, but your average person doesn't have a supercomputer or a quantum computer in their garage, they're not going to be able to decrypt it. So you don't know what's there. And the only way you know is by asking the people who did the encryption, well, what did you put in there? We can't see it. Can you tell us? And all you can really do is trust and hope that they're telling the truth about what they're encrypting. So I thought it was worth doing an episode because I love this stuff. If that wasn't clear. But more than loving it and thinking it's interesting, it really kind of raised some questions for me. I mean, as someone who, like the vast majority of folks, are not deepfaking people without their, you know, consent. I give my own consent to be deepfaked. I deepfaking myself. But I still love these technologies, but it's a little bit disconcerting really to know that at the very least, I think there should be transparency that if you sign up for a service like Gemini, and they're advertising in big bold writing their AI offering and Nano Banana, etc., everyone using these services deserves an answer to the question, can you tell me about the fingerprinting, the synth ID, and exactly what level? Is it just generated by AI, or is it personally identifiable? Even if it might be, if it's only internally accessible, it does mean that, like, people worry for VPNs about subpoenas. Once it is at that level, with companies that comply with the law, there's your answer. So I think it's something that should be more transparent. I do think it's a balancing act, but I think that there's a danger that in sort of trying to defeat the minority of folks who are maybe this bot-infested wasteland I described of everyone deepfaking one another as being a possibility that is actually a very, very real thing. That calls for some protective mechanisms. But to say this, a very, very small group of folks, the technology companies making these tools, every time someone uses them, they are leaving a trace exactly that, you know, tracing back to them when they created something. That practice, my view would be that it has to be to the minimum extent necessary for effective enforcement to cut down on, to prosecute black hat and illegal usage. And anything beyond that is an unnecessary invasion of user privacy. So that's my take on the matter. I thought that would just be an interesting thing to talk about. I have to do a lot more. I have to do some more reading on this myself, but cool discussion, I hope, at least. Until the next time, thanks for listening to another episode of Daniel's Word Prompts today. Just Daniel not prompting, but Daniel just speaking himself. And if you do like this and you do want to hear the stuff that I talk about and the charming AI characters who answer my prompts, namely Cornelius the Sloth, which is a voice clone of me. I voice cloned a fake animal, so I think it's legal. And a voice clone of Herman Poppleberry, who I'm looking at now, who's a rather delightful stuffed donkey that was kindly given to us by a family, and which our son likes, and so do I. So Corn and Herman were brought to life through me doing their voices into a microphone, and then Chatterbox cloning, really me cloning a stuffed animal, if you really want to think about it like that. Hey, it's a matrix. AI is a matrix. That's why I love it. It's fun. It's weird. There are definitely people doing bad things with it, but I don't think that's a reason to dislike it. And I think there is privacy and clamping down on deepfakes for sure. Prosecuted, has to be prosecuted, but while in the process of doing that, I think we have to be conscious of the very real potential for significant abuse of power on the part of a small group of companies. And these practices really need to be clear and not something that, if you're nerding out on this topic, you figure out, but it has to be something that is spelled out in plain language for users. Whether the companies think that that's going to freak out users, that's fine. They deserve really to know that, I think. All right, that's it. Until next time, thanks for listening.